Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guests today are a current and former columnist for the Chico Enterprise Record. Later in the hour, book reviewer Dan Barnett will tell us about his favorite local history books, which came out in the year 2016. Eric Miller grew up in Colorado and has lived in Northern California over 20 years. He has a BS in hydrology from Colorado State University and an MBA in marketing from the University of California at Davis. He has been a chemist, lab technician, hazardous waste manager, landfill manager, water resources manager, karate instructor, and a Weight Watchers facilitator. Before moving to Chico, Eric Miller wrote a column called Garbage Talk, which appeared in the Davis Enterprise and the Woodland Daily Democrat. In 2012, he wrote a monthly column for the Chico Enterprise Record in North State Voices and has now published his first book called Let Me Tell You a Story. Eric Miller, welcome.
Thank you.
You refer to this book you've written because I call the title Let Me Tell You a Story. But in bigger print on the cover of your book, it says, Et Cetera Guy. Is that your alter ego?
That's an alter ego. And unfortunately, Et Cetera Guy is not paying me my bills. But hopefully that'll change. But the Et Cetera Guy was actually named by my daughters. We were driving down Interstate 5 to the Bay Area, and I was encouraged to continue on my writing career beyond North State Voices with the Chico Enterprise Record. And I was thinking, well, what do we call this thing? I mean, nobody knows me from Adam. And the only thing that came to my mind was from Anna and the King and I, and Yul Brynner, who's in charge of this island and an army. And he has this governess who's hired to modernize his life and his country, and how she tells him what to do, and he runs around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, well, how does that? Because the kids love the movie, too. And that's how it started.
Well, you have written a lot of magazine articles, columns. So why did you decide to write a book?
Oh, I was actually encouraged by some of the feedback from the Et Cetera Guy blog. People suggested, well, why don't you culminate this stuff or organize this stuff into a book? And I thought, are you kidding? And then talked to some other people, some other writers, and they encouraged me to do the same. And then as I've studied this whole blog process, and I'm still learning a lot about it, especially the technology, I thought, you know, it's easier for somebody to pick up a book, 130 or so pages, than it is for them to sit in front of a computer for a couple hours and just try to find where these articles are located, whether it's a sports article or aging or parenting or that sort of thing. So we experimented with the publication process, and it came out to over 130 pages. And quite frankly, I didn't realize I had that much baloney in me, but there's plenty more ahead, too.
Well, one of your the readers of your blog came back with a quote that I thought about you. And the reader of the blog says, quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson, "Do not be too timid and squeamish about your actions. All life is an experiment."
You know, I get some great quotes from these readers, and sometimes I can't tell if they're real people or if it's just somebody next door. I sift through some of the blog comments and come up, there's some good ones like that, which also inspires you to keep going. Because as a writer, you really don't know how you're doing unless you hear from people.
Well, I was curious that you wrote this. Well, it seemed to fit your experience, your job experience, for example, to be writing a column about garbage. But you were saying you don't know if people read it unless you hear back from them. But I would think you would be getting a good bit of response from people in the Davis area if you're talking about garbage.
Well, that was over 20 years ago. So that was before Al Gore invented the internet, you see. So we didn't have this Facebook. We didn't have the digital media. That started when I was a recycling coordinator for Yolo County, and I was doing stories on what came in at the landfill each day. And at that time, the city of Woodland hosted a Target distribution center for all their inventory in Northern California. And one day, a semi-trailer of laundry detergent came into the landfill. So I wrote a story about the day the tide rolled in at the landfill, and it I didn't hear much from people, but people later said, you know, that was a pretty good one. I like that. And so that's how I got into this kind of goofy twist on looking at things.
But I think people would be interested in what shows up in a landfill.
Oh, yeah. I've seen trailers. I've seen all kinds of crazy things come in the landfill. And you kind of wonder, when I was a solid waste manager at the Neal Road landfill almost 20 years ago, I saw a travel trailer come in and was backed up onto the disposal area. And I was just thinking, what's this guy doing? And the next thing I know, a crew of three guys comes out. They jack up the trailer, lift it with hydraulic jacks, remove the tires, and they drove away. And I thought, well, what do you guys do? Well, it was cheaper to get rid of it than to abandon it. And I thought, well, okay. I never thought of it that way, but it was. They wanted to recycle the tires, though.
My guest is Eric Miller, and he has written a book, Let Me Tell You a Story. And this story is called Even Hockey Coaches Have Hearts. You have occasion to track down your coach.
Yes. This was first appeared in the North State Voices column. I received an email from an old friend of mine who says, I thought you might like to read this. And I was, the heading said Wayne Marshall, and I was afraid to open the email. I thought it was an obituary. And it turned out they had won the Colorado State High School Association's Hall of Fame Award. And I subsequently tracked him down. I spoke to his wife. I thought maybe, you know, Mrs. Marshall, I played with Coach in 1980. I just want to say hello to him and congratulate him. And
no idea that she would remember you.
I had no idea she would remember me, and she did. And he called me the next day, and I interviewed him, and then he shared with me that on a Christmas Eve a number of years ago, or 2 or 3 years ago, he had an open emergency heart surgery. And then I remember him as a tough, grumbling SOB. But he was just has a heart of gold, and he had a soft, quiet voice when I spoke with him. And it was very we just picked up like in a conversation like we just had it yesterday. But 30 years had gone by, and I just thanked him for the impact that he made on my life and for encouraging me. And I knew all of his critiques were never personal. They were all purposeful.
You know, those of us who are teachers remember our students from years back. And I think maybe students don't realize that.
Right. In the closing sentence or paragraph in that story about even hockey coaches have
well,
heart.
Before you yeah. get to the closing, because you made me cry with that one, Eric.
Oh, was it that bad?
But before you got to that, you made me laugh. And because the coach was saying that he said, your passing has improved. Oh, and you think, oh, well, that's good. Thanks, coach. And then you said, yeah, it's gone from terrible to bad. Then you said someone with a sensitive ego would have sulked, but I actually felt complimented. Consider the entire spectrum on the improvement scale. I went from terrible to bad. I was on the way to becoming poor, climbing the ladder to fair, good, excellent, and then ultimately awesome. So when your coach tells you you've improved, you're happy to hear that. It's just you improved from terrible to bad.
That's right. I remember that day. I was walking into the gym, and Miller, get in here. And I'm thinking, oh, brother, what does he want now? Just like any 17-year-old kid looks at an adult. And at this time, he seemed ancient to me. I don't even think he was 40 years old. But he says, come in here. Your passing's just... it's terrible. It was awful. And so when I tried in college, that was one of the reasons why I didn't make the team. A terrible passing.
So your hockey career ended with your high school career.
It did.
But then now, how do you conclude this story about Coach?
Okay. The last paragraphs are in that particular story. Hockey coaches aren't known for their cuddliness. Though Coach was tough on me, I wanted him to know that I appreciated him. His corrections were never personal. He sought to help me become better. Very rarely do we express our appreciation to others, whether it's a family member, friend, teacher, or boss. But if you get the chance, tell them now while they're still living. They won't hear you after they're gone.
This is Eric Miller. He's reading from his collection of stories, Let Me Tell You a Story. I don't know if some people might disagree with you there when you say they won't hear you after they're gone.
Yes. Well, Maybe some would disagree. I would hope that they can hear us after they're gone.
But the moral of the story is
tell them now. That's right.
Well, you have different topics that you cover in your book, and some of them have to do with taking care of home and yard. And there is a story in there where Stuart the gopher loses the war. What about that story, Eric?
Okay, my wife is really the yard connoisseur. I just run lawn mowers and typically run over garden hoses and rocks and tennis balls that the dogs leave out. But that particular story was inspired one Christmas morning when one of our tomcats brought a gopher inside the house. It was Christmas morning, and I was the first one up, and I was had a nice hot cup of coffee, looking at the Christmas tree, meditating on the reason for the season. Looked at some of the Christmas story in the New Testament. I'm thinking, you know, this is just the perfect morning. And then the kids slowly start waking up, and then one of them shrieked, "Dad, there's a gopher in the house!" And then that's when all hell broke loose, and we were chasing this gopher around the house on Christmas morning. And then how my wife, you know, says to me, "Kill it. Take it outside. Do something with it." And I said, "Well, come on. We're celebrating the birth of Jesus. What? I can't do this today. I'm just not mentally there." And it's how she took care of it. And then I got to thinking, why are gophers so active during the wintertime? And then I did some research on the state fish and game website and looked on some technical journals and wrote that story about how gophers migrate and how they're polygamous. I don't know how they figured that out. Somebody studied that, a polygamy in gophers. And how I think we should create a new demand with these gophers.
You didn't want to kill the gopher and you didn't want to, so you're kind of stuck. You came up with an alternative that most people wouldn't consider.
Well, I would suggest that people trap them and actually eat them. I found actually a recipe on cook.com for gopher stew, and all you need is about 18 gophers to make it. And it was totally serious. And all you need to do is catch about 18 gophers and butcher them.
But could you find enough friends and family to eat gophers?
No.
That you need to cook that many?
I'm sure there's plenty of gophers out there.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Yeah, but, I think that would kind of unsettle the neighborhood if there was a big gopher hunt. But that's how that story went. And I've got some hunting friends of mine in town, and I'm always teasing them. They're always talking about fishing and hunting and this and that. And I said, look, you guys, you should just really catch gophers, learn how to cook them. You'd make a bajillion dollars here in Northern California. So.
Well, you have, speaking of holidays, you deal with Halloween, with Christmas. You say Christmas, wife trumps husband at Christmas.
Right. That story, it's centered back on a weed eater incident where we had two of them, and I couldn't start one of them. And I took it apart and tried to reassemble it, and I just had nothing but a pile of spare parts, and I was very frustrated. So I put that weed eater out on the front yard with a free sign. And then my wife, Hun, asked me where the weed eater is, and I said, well, it doesn't work, you know, all kinds of problems. So I put it on the curb with a free sign, and then she peered over the fence, and it was gone. And that's when the argument started. And how over a period of time, 6 months later, she actually said that, you gave away your weed eater. Well, I thought, no, we're a communal state. This is our weed
you
eater.
You had the mistaken impression it was our weed eater.
I was under the impression it was our family weed eater. But no, it all of a sudden became my weed eater.
That you had given away.
That I had given away. And so we had a backup weed eater, which now we have this new Husqvarna weed eater, which is awesome because it's more powerful than a Toyota Prius. But about 6 months after that summer incident, Hun came in with a kennel in the back of the SUV, and she asked me to unload it. And I said, well, sure. You know, I said, what is it? She said, it's a Christmas present. And so I asked her, do you want me to wrap it? She says, nah, you can't wrap. You're short on the corners. You always wreck it. It's a train wreck when you try to wrap presents. And I said, well, you can take it inside. And I said, okay, fine. And I looked inside, opened a box inside of a box because she's kind of a trickster. And I looked inside this kennel and I saw this nose and the crooked teeth and a horn. Then I heard this, bah. Like, what are you doing here? What gives? And she says, Merry Christmas. That's your, for the husband who has everything. This is your new weed eater. So she gave me a goat for Christmas, and it was about the size of a rat terrier.
Little goat. You have a photograph of it.
I have a photo. That's right. It was a cute little goat. We named her Nestle. She followed me around the backyard with all our other critters.
My guest is Eric Miller, and he has collected stories. His collection is called Let Me Tell You a Story. And you mentioned this project that you undertook. And I was guessing before you mentioned who some of your favorite writers were, I could guess who they were, mm-hmm. just from your style, who some of your favorite writers were. And you call this the Humor Project, and you actually went on the road to interview some of your favorites. We don't have time to talk about those, but just briefly, who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I really enjoy, of course, Dave Barry is just phenomenal. But Will Durst is another person I enjoy reading, a political satirist. Pat McManus, who's a humor writer for Field and Stream, a New York Times bestseller. Jeffrey Bergeron in Colorado. All these folks are just, you pick up their books or their articles, and you are entertained from the first word. And so it's been a process of mine to reach out and try to interview these folks as part of my humor project, and maybe that'll turn into another book.
And you have favorites going back to Irma Bombeck, Andy Rooney. I noticed Bill Geist in that list.
Oh,
and, of course, Public Radio's Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor. And I actually I was in the audience when he was visiting Chico a couple years ago, and he just floored me. It's just amazing. Yeah, Andy Rooney, Mark Twain. So I think one question posed by Pat McManus on his site is, where have all the humor writers gone? So that's been my my query. Where are they? Where are these people? Is our sense of humor changing? Are we losing? Is it because of technology? Is it because of our personal tastes and preferences? What is it? Where are these people? Let's meet them.
So you have, where are your new heroes?
Yeah, so I've done the learning new heroes, and well, I'd love to become one, but there's a few people on this list who are national writers, and Joel Stein from Time Magazine.
Yes, I saw him.
Very edgy, but that's where they take you, and they take you to the margins of edginess, and it's up to you as the reader to determine whether it's been crossed.
It's been a pleasure reading your stories and talking to you, Eric.
Thank you.
My guest has been Eric Miller. His book is Let Me Tell You a Story. Eric had a story published this month in Hockey Player magazine, which I'm going to ask him to read. It's called The Dork.
This story is for all the has-been athletes out there, or anyone who's done anything in a group with a group of different people. The story is called The Dork. Every team has one. Whether it's baseball, basketball, or badminton, there's always that one guy who doesn't quite enmesh locker room society. Maybe it's his or her lousy jokes, bad breath, or that they wear turtlenecks year-round. For me, it was Marvin Smellmore's nose. The average length of an adult nose is about 5.8 centimeters, two-thirds the diameter of a hockey puck. Marv's beak, shy of 8 centimeters, poked outside his helmet's cage. Migrant birds eyed Marv's nose as a potential perch. I tried overlooking Marv's schnoz. I was one of the team's captains, chosen by coach because I supposedly exhibited good citizenship. But Marv's physiological anomaly was difficult to ignore. One couldn't help but gaze at such a magnificent proboscis. Smellmore's face was graced by a glorious, wondrous, and mysterious marvel. Smellmore didn't fraternize with teammates during the school day, preferring to hang around math geeks who sketched parabolas and chalkboards during lunch. Marv earned straight A's in math, algebra, geometry, trigonometry. Good news, because coach required that student athletes earn a C average to play. Marvin's A's in math courses offset the C's he got in sex ed. A third line forward, Marv rarely scored. At 6 feet tall, Marv had pale skin, moles on his knees and elbows, rail-thin arms, and a 38-inch waistline. He weighed about 135 pounds wearing hockey gear. Not a single bicep or triceps bulged. Renowned for his weak shot, Smelmore's velvety hands could fit inside Pringles cans. His team contribution was back-checking. Marv terrorized opponents, his arms spinning from all sides of his torso. He took out not only opponents, but occasionally a referee. While resting on the bench, we never leaned over the boards when Smelmore skated by, lest we catch splinters from his stick. The poor guy was subject to devious hazing. Just before a late-night practice, an anonymous teammate implemented a scheme. Coach just finished a chalk talk and stepped outside the locker room for a cigarette. Marv patrolled the room, mooching an extra stick. Mr. Anonymous tiptoed to Marv's gear bag, heisted his skates, and stretched scotch tape across the inner and outer edges of the blades. The rest of us snickered when Coach roared from the hallway, "Get on the ice, boys!" Dull and skate blades are suicide. We scurried towards Coach, who waited at the Zamboni entrance. Last in line, Marv took a header when his skates contacted the ice. Smelmore's face shield didn't shield a classic face plant. Ice shavings clung to Marv's nostrils. Coach frowned. "Smelmore, get your act together. You're sprawled like a deer on ice." "My skates, they're bars of soap," Winston embarrassed Smelmore. Coach pulled out a handkerchief and wiped melting frost from Marv's nose. "Let me see." Coach inspected Marv's blades. "Who taped Smelmore's skate blades?" Coach growled. "Peel off that tape," Coach whispered to Smelmore. "As for the rest of you, get on the goal line." Perhaps it was a nicotine deficiency between smokes, but we noticed a lacking sense of humor from Coach. "You guys think that's funny? I'll show you funny. Give me 20 blue lines, and we'll see who laughs." We never again taped Snellmore skates. Coach's temper scared us too much. I've often wondered what became of Marvin Smellmore. I lost track of him during my fifth year of college. I heard that Marv graduated in 4 years with an engineering degree and that he cheered at college football games with the cheerleading team. He reportedly trained 5 days a week tossing and catching girls. 35 years have passed since that practical joke. I now skate in an adult recreation league and can't say that we have dorks in our group. Maybe I've matured, or maybe I'm blind to vain matters like people's noses. The passage of time mellows the soul and gives one pause to consider past transgressions. It was unjust and uncool to pick on a weaker player, especially a teammate. Marvin Smelmore was simply a dedicated hockey player who loved the game and fought for his teammates, even if he only skated intermittent shifts. If Marv ever appeared at my rink today, I'd greet him like an old friend, one that deserved better treatment during high school. I'd invite him to play in my team. We'd have a brew afterwards, and I'd confess my role in the scotch tape fiasco. Hopefully he'd laugh beer through his nose.
Thanks, Eric. That was Eric Miller reading his short story, The Dork. Earlier, Eric told us a Christmas story about a husband, wife, and a weed eater. Wife trumps husband at Christmas. Now, with New Year's only a couple of days away, I'd like for Eric to read one more of his short stories. Time well spent is all he wants.
This story was written at New Year's 2013, but I changed it a little bit based on a conversation I had with one of my kids. The story is called Time Well Spent is All He Wants. No matter where you are at any given moment today, it's either tomorrow or yesterday somewhere else. Years ago, I visited Sweden, which is 9 hours ahead of California. I returned to work, and a colleague handed me a fax sent from Stockholm. He pointed to the date and time. "Here's a message from tomorrow," he chuckled. I shared this story with Maggie, my seventh grader at the time, who worried about the end of the Mayan calendar, December 21st, 2012. "The world can't end," she sniffed. "I want to grow up and open a beachfront cafe. I have a lot to do." I tested faith-based rationale. "Only God knows when the world ends," I soothed. Maggie still seemed anxious. My youngest daughter is a linear thinker. "No worries, kid. It's already tomorrow in Australia," If the world was ending, it would be on the news by now. She smiled and hopped upstairs. The imminent New Year gives me reason to pause. We expend time in blocks of minutes, days, or years. They often pass by without our noticing. Consider 1 minute when either a decision we make or action we take possibly affects our life's outcome. In only a minute, we can miss a plane and an opportunity. We can make or lose fortunes. We can lose or gain a loved one. Time cannot be bought, but it does have a price. It's only free when you don't have to do anything or be anywhere. Often, there is little regard for how we use it. My wife gifted me time one Christmas. She told me exactly what she wanted, where to get it, and saved me from playing shopping roulette. She pined for a workbench vise, preferably one to clamp 2x4s and not my skull. I executed Operation Sweeper off her feet with a trip to the hardware store. I went from a time deficit to time spared. I figured I'd use the extra time to do something she wanted. She decided on a family shopping trip to a big city mall. The four of us walked inside single file. I noticed a congregation of leaners, sitters, and snoozers, guys biding their time waiting for their mates. My mate split the clan. I had Kate, the 10th grader, and she took Maggie. I trudged behind Kate, who hunted for a deal. A mixture of holiday and rap music blared throughout the store. She zeroed in on a target and removed a woolen item. It had the circumference of a bike tire. "What's that?" I asked. "An infinity scarf," she said. "It's a circle, so you don't have to tie it." I wondered how many minutes it takes to tie a regular scarf. She scurried off. I remained alone in no man's land next to a rack of scarves. I scanned the store and drifted into the intimate apparel section, an area that befuddles most guys. A sales clerk intercepted me. "Can I help you find something for your daughter?" "Egad, no. It's for your wife, then?" An uneasy feeling chilled my soul. A premonition warned me of danger. I turned to see my wife's glare. My mate stood tall with arms crossed, frowning. It was time for me to relocate. "No luck finding binoculars," I told her. She wasn't amused. I decided at that moment to trust my instinct. Never pass on a good opportunity to shut up. My testosterone level sank to pre-intimate apparel conditions. I'm ready for 2018, but won't overlook the remaining days of 2017. I'll yearn to enjoy each moment and not take anything for granted. I'll watch for the positive and amusing episodes that occur on any given day. I'll make sure you notice them. I appreciate reader support for Etc. Guy this past year. Many of you sent thoughtful and encouraging notes. I'll continue writing. I hope that my best times as a writer are yet to come.
That was author Eric Miller reading "Time Well Spent Is All He Wants." Thank you, Eric. After a short break, I'm going to be asking book reviewer Dan Barnett which books by local authors impressed him in this past year. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Every week, the book review column Bibliophile appears in the Sunday art section of the Chico Enterprise Record. Dan Barnett has been reviewing the work of local authors for about 29 years. Before
You're kidding.
Well, isn't it true, Dan?
Yes,
My goodness.
My goodness,
29 years. Before that, he had jobs in local radio for 30 years. He was half of the Bennett and Barnett morning team. Gary Bennett played the music, and Dan Barnett did the news and read sports. Now, Dan Barnett teaches philosophy full-time at Butte College and helps direct the school's online program as distance learning coordinator. He's also involved in the Chico Triad, a discussion group on philosophy, theology, and science. I've invited Dan to join me in looking back at local authors of this past year, 2016. Dan Barnett, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Who did all those things?
Well, it couldn't have been you, could it?
I must be 112 years old.
Well, we have so many books that you and I are both so enthusiastic about. Mm. Where do we even begin, Dan?
I'd like to begin with my book of the year. What can I say? There are many, many wonderful books that I read and got a chance to write about and let readers know about. But The Road to Cherokee, a California epic, the first novel published by ANCHOR, that's the Association for Northern California Historical Research, by Mary Ray King, stole my heart. It's a historical romance, and I usually, it's, you know, about history and so forth, but it's about local history. And it's about what life would actually be like if you started on the Pioneer Trail and you ended up here in Northern California in the Cherokee area. And I was really taken by the story. It's it has tragedy. It has love. It has miners against farmers. And it's all local. It's as if you turned around and there was General John Bidwell at Safeway picking up some goods, you know. And it just makes our own history come alive. And so I really recommend that. And you can get it at various local outlets throughout the North Valley, or you can get a hold of ANCHOR, A-N-C-H-R, the Association for Northern California Historical Research.
Well, now, Dan, you write a review, and so your author doesn't have to actually be alive. Now, I can't review this author that you're just talking about because she is deceased.
She is. And it's very interesting. Mary Ray McIntyre King died on March 20th, 1949, at a rest home in Oroville, where she'd lived the last few months of her life. Her adventurous spirit was at rest, says the introduction. Beside her bed, in a box, were the typed sheets of the completed manuscript of The Road to Cherokee. Her last handwritten edits have been incorporated into this first-time publication of her novel.
So she dies before this book that she has written ever sees daylight.
That's right. In 2015, Jean Wiles, she's the granddaughter of Mary Ray King, contacted the Butte County Historical Society about her grandmother's writings, and eventually the manuscript came to ANCHOR. And it's quite a story about not only the story, but Mary Ray McIntyre King herself. She was the first female attorney in Butte County, and there are many stories in this beginning passage of the book. And what's really good about how they've edited The Road to Cherokee is that there's a biography, Nancy Leake wrote that, of Mary Ray King. And then Ron Womack and Josie Smith wrote an introduction to kind of place Cherokee and its history, including the geology, into historical context. And then there are footnotes scattered throughout the novel to bring readers up to date about what was being referred to and then what has happened since that time.
Well, may I add, too, as a sidetrack, you mentioned Nancy Leake. And she writes such interesting books, I think. And she is not a historian by profession, by training. She is a librarian. But she really knows local history.
And Mary Ray King is a poet. And in the introduction, it says she conceived the idea of a novel set in Butte County, which she knew so well, that would tell a story about the struggle of farmers to preserve their land from the slickens that poured down from the hydraulic mines at Cherokee. And those of us who live in this area, in the area referred to in the novel, can just look around us and we can imagine, oh yeah, that was sort of here. That was just down that ridge. That was just over there. And that made this novel just come alive. I was simply taken by it. In the mid-1870s, according to the introduction, the town of Cherokee just was booming. The demand for produce, meat, supplies from valley farms increased. Stage lines were added. The mines were going. By 1874, 16 chiefs were operating, and each month's clean-out realized $70,000 in revenue. In one particular month, the mine paid about $40,000 in dividends. So a lot of money was being taken out of the mines. And then suddenly, that mining stopped. And that was because of a lawsuit. And that changed the history of Northern California and maybe the world forever. That at first, the farmers downstream, there was some rich soil that was being washed down as part of the slickens. And that's kind of nice. But then it got huge. And the amount of debris that was washed down from the hydraulic mines clogged the rivers and the streams. And in fact, inundated whole farmland, so they were impossible to use. And that produced incredible tension. And that led to a lawsuit, and the mining operations lost the suit that hydraulic mining no longer could operate in at least Northern California. And eventually, everything wound down as far as the Cherokee operation was concerned, because that particular mining company in that area, the Spring Valley Mine, had bought some stream areas, and so it could use that as runoff. But other mining operations, hydraulic mining operations, had not, and they couldn't go anywhere, and so they just shut down. And so, but this novel talks about the price that really is paid. There's some tragedy, loss of life, and so on. And a farmer who is very, very upset with what's happening to his pioneer partner, as he and his partner's family, they're both families, headed out west, eventually winding up in this area, in the Cherokee area. And they grew apart because one wanted land of his own to farm on and the other wanted to mine. And it's like a movie. It's just quite amazing. There's some wonderful passages that I like in the book. We'll see if I can just light on one. One is one of the characters is going into John Bidwell's office because the president of the United States is coming to visit Chico. Do you remember that?
Oh, well, I remember reading it in history books.
I was just catching. Yes, I was just asking. And so there is a passage where one of the characters comes in and talks to John Bidwell and says, you are going to be showing the President of the United States around. And what I want you to do, General Bidwell, is please tell him of the terrible, terrible things that are happening with the slickens and with the hydraulic mines. And General Bidwell well, responded like this. So found the passage. Here it is. So Sam is the character who is the farmer, and he's had this falling out with the miners. And so he is talking to General Bidwell. Says Sam, "I'm devoting my life and energies to saving the state you helped win for us," said Sam. "We're trying to save the Great Valley from the destruction caused by hydraulic mining." "You've never found me remiss in helping you, Sam," the general said, General Bidwell, smiling encouragingly. "What do you need now, my friend?" "Not money," said Sam hurriedly. "This time I ask for some personal work on your part with the president." The general looked at Sam inquiringly. "I hear that you will entertain the president and his party here at the mansion, and then next day take them up to see the Cherokee mines. I thought that you might privately talk with the president about the havoc wrought by the mines, about the necessity of congressional action against the hydraulic miners. I thought..." "The president has eyes," said the general. "He will see what he will see. Isn't that enough?" "No, no," cried Sam passionately. "This is hardly a matter for presidential interference," said the general, as if thinking aloud. "We still have recourse to the legislature and to our Congress and the courts. It might prove very offensive to my guest to be asked to interject himself into what he might think to be a local matter or beyond executive powers." Well, then the day came, September 23rd, 1880. I remember it well. It was a sunny day. Gala day in Chico. President Rutherford B. Hayes and a party including Mrs. Hayes, General Sherman, Miss Rachel Sherman, Major General McDowell, General McCook, and a number of others were entertained by General Bidwell at the mansion. Interesting footnote, we don't know whether Annie was present or not. We think she was on a trip somewhere. And then President Hayes goes up to the Cherokee area and enjoys himself. And whether he sees what was going on or not, we don't know. But this is invented conversation, but I was just taken in, as you can see, as you can tell.
My guest is Book Review columnist Den Barnett. He writes the bibliophile column in the Chico Enterprise Record, and he has just been reading from The Road to Cherokee, which is his book of the year, his choice as book of the year, about local history. And this... this road to Cherokee may have a mention of Mother Orange Tree, Dan?
Yeah, it's very interesting. The several books that I've read this year mention the Mother Orange Tree. And there's another history book.
Had you heard of the Mother Orange Tree before you started reading these books?
I might have. I mean, you know, been around for a long time, so maybe somebody mentioned something. But this was really brought to light in a book called A Short Golden Life, The Town of Bidwell at Bidwell Bar, 1848 to 1860, Volume 2 by Chuck Smay. And this is...
surprises me because this is the second in two volumes, and this is quite a thick book.
It's a very thick book.
And it's already Volume 2.
Yeah, about 2010, he published Volume 1 and found more research. I mean, sometimes you just, as an amateur historian, you just... can't put it down because there's more to learn about what went on in this town that became, at one time, for a couple of years at least, the seat of Butte County and now is underwater. And it's just really fascinating. But he says, many years after the county seat was relocated to their rival Oroville, recreation became the focus of Bidwell's Bar area. Visitors of that later era may have wondered about the thriving community that once existed near the swimming hole by the bridges. Three of the remaining icons located on the east edge of the town, the bridge, the toll house, and the Mother Orange Tree, were removed to higher ground before November 14, 1967, when the waters filling the lake behind Oroville Dam covered the town site from future curious eyes. So there's a whole world that is explored in this book Short Golden Life, The Town of Bidwell at Bidwell's Bar, 1848 to 1860. And not only is it in the past, but it is covered by water. And so there was the mention of the Mother Orange Tree. And then, speaking of local history, which we are, comes one a book in the series Images of America. And this is called The Lost Communities of Lake Oroville. And that includes the Bidwell's Bar area, by Larry R. Matthews and Scott C. Roberts. And both of them have connections to local radio, so they've been around for a long time. And this talks about 1967. There's a picture in the Images of America. They're big black and white photographs, two or three or one per page, with extensive captioning. And it's just wonderful. You just page through it. It's like looking through a friend's album, only the captions are so good, they tell you who you're looking at.
Well, I enjoy this series, Images of America, because then it makes me want to drive down and look at these places,
wherever
they might be locally.
Here's one you can't see, though. And so there's a picture of Bill Leeson, a man standing on one side of the riverbank of the Feather River in March 1968. And the caption says he's watching the progress of the rise of the water on the Big Bend Powerhouse. The powerhouse was shut down at 11:59 p.m., September 30th, 1967, and November 14th, the gates on the Oroville Dam were closed. The water that would create Lake Oroville began to rise. Now, imagine, I think there may be some listeners who watched this happen. At the time, Leeson was vice president of the Butte County Historical Society. He left a great legacy of research on Las Plumas, Big Bend Powerhouse, and much of the information is courtesy of what Bill has done. And so you see him standing, looking across the Feather River, and Big Bend Powerhouse is half submerged. And I wonder how fast that happened, whether you could just watch that and 10 minutes later you could actually see the water rise. I don't know. But so much was inundated. And then what this book does, it's our fairly recent drought period made some of the areas that had been covered.
Exposed
by, them. Yes. And so there's some pictures of that. And it does talk about the Mother Orange Tree.
Getting back to this triple mention in three different books of the Mother Orange Tree.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it tells about some of the relocation of these icons. There is... I don't want to get ahead of myself, but as we're talking about the toll bridge and the Mother Orange Tree and so forth, it talks about that. But there's a striking photograph taken in 2014. Lake Oroville had dropped, and so one of the authors of the book is standing by a couple of rocks, and there's just nothing there. It's just mud, you know, where the water has receded. In this photograph is the location of the Mountain Spring School at Enterprise. There was a little town of Enterprise. And an earlier photograph shows the school, and you see that rock. And so it's a strange phenomenon that you can imagine. You could actually go out, at least in 2014 when the water was low, see that rock, and pull up the picture of that school, the Mountain Springs School at Enterprise, and imagine that instead of just mud, there was a thriving community. I really was taken with this book as well, The Lost Communities of Lake Oroville. It's published by Arcadia Publishing. They have thousands of Images of America books, and this is really wonderful.
My guest is Dan Barnett. He is the columnist and book reviewer for the Chico Enterprise Record, and he has been telling us about some of his favorite on the topic of local history.
Yeah.
But I see you also brought a copy of Neil Snyder's Vista del Mar.
Yeah.
Dan, what did you want to say about his book?
Well, Neil, of course, is a colleague at Butte College before he retired, and I teach philosophy there, and he teaches language arts, English, you know, writing, that sort of thing. And this really is a memoir. It's not a local history book, but it does recall some of the history of Southern California. The pictures are very striking, lots and lots of black and white pictures, very prosaic. Because this was...
Because what does he call it? The subtitle of that book, Vista del Mar, A Memoir of the Ordinary.
Yeah. And, you know, instead of incredibly striking landscapes, just
like in the previous
stuff,
book you were talking about.
Yeah.
His photographs are ordinary.
Yeah. Here's a parking lot and, you know, a tree and a garage and so forth. And... It's an interesting memoir because he is watching himself thinking about his past and how it – there's a kind of loop that's going on. And so there's a
– Even the structure of the book is
yeah,
like that.
There's a paragraph. It says, time had now looped on, doubled back, left the impression of its meander, its oxbows, its climax meadows, its shallows – sloughs, outer reaches, littorals, depths, and trenches as it moved on. There's time moving on. For a period, it was the fall of 1996, and we were beginning the adoption process, attending a weekend seminar in the Bay Area, in a busy inland suburban area with malls and freeways, green spaces and developments. Then over the winter, we made contact with our birth mother and made our agreement to adopt her child due in late May. The process was complicated and emotional, and each new step seemed overwhelming and fraught with difficulty. But the saving grace was that not only did we all need each other badly by this time, birth mother and adopting couple and agency, but that day by day, the baby was on its way. So finally, we got a phone call that our birth mother was in labor, and we drove excitedly down to the Bay Area for the birth. Now, another
person. By the way, this is Dan Barnett reading from A Memoir of the Ordinary,
right,
written by a colleague of his, Neil Snyder.
Right. And another person could just say, yeah, we got a phone call, and we went down to the birth mother. But he frames it in terms of time, and time does strange things as you're writing a memoir, and just really very, very striking. So good stuff this year.
Well, what other books struck you this year that we should maybe call to the listener's attention not to miss?
Well, this is a coffee table book, and
this, the one you have in front of you right now that you're going to talk about.
Do you not see that on the radio? Look more carefully, please. Huge book. It's called Special Delivery. It's really a history of the post office, not the local post office so much as the American Post Office.
Although the author
Myers
does mention our local post office, and
sure does.
I had a nice chat with her last Friday.
Yeah, it is really fun because on every page it's new information, like postal uniforms. There's a picture of Cliff Clavin's outfit.
The Postman on Cheers,
yeah,
the TV series.
And there's Mary Fields. She's known as Stagecoach Mary or Black Mary, started carrying the mail in 1895 as a 6-foot-tall black woman who carried a revolver and a rifle. Mary was not out of place in a Western saloon and enjoyed smoking cigars. Stories from Mary's colorful life include a legend that recalls her fending off a pack of wolves through one long night. Mary was also popular for her community commitment. When she wasn't drinking, fighting, or delivering the mail, or performing manual labor, Mary gave food to the poor and bought treats for the town children. And there's a picture of Mary.
And there's a photograph of
you
this.
You do not want to mess with Mary Fields, I'll tell you that.
And she was called Black Mary or Stagecoach Mary.
Mm-hmm.
But Dan, on the very opposite page was also a woman, she looked like a girl, a letter carrier, who was somewhat the opposite of Stagecoach Mary.
Yeah.
And she looks quite petite. Stagecoach mm-hmm. Mary, 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
And this young girl in the photograph on the opposite page.
Yeah. And there's a section of art on post offices, and there's a picture in the Chico post office and downtown.
A nice color picture, and it looks like it was taken unposed, but yet she's got a nice mailman alongside that mural.
I know, a mail carrier there. And there's a lot of postal art in various cities and post offices. And there's also a section on pen pals and some interesting folks who were pen pals like Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln.
Who would
have
thought?
Are you kidding? They were pen pals?
Well, they did have a little bit in common. She mentions that.
Yeah. So you'll have to read the book to find out how they were pen pals.
And also, speaking of Marx, there was another famous Marx, and that was Groucho Marx.
Right. Pen pal with T.S. Eliot, the poet. Are you kidding? My goodness. And the author said that she...
The author is Marcia Myers, by the way.
I went to school in the 1980s, she says, and those days still had chalkboards in our classrooms. What was that like? Actually, I know what that was like. Yes. She said, I had a unique and special form of communication with a boy who attended the same classroom earlier in the day. My class was last period, and if I checked the corner of the chalkboard rail, there would be a small stack of chalk. At the bottom, I eagerly anticipated there would be a note written in pencil on a piece of chalk for me. My chalk note friend at a class a few hours before me, we meticulously corresponded with each other secretly by way of chalk daily. If he had to wait longer to read the one I left for him, as my class was last period, he wouldn't be back in the room until the following morning. We always feared the teacher would find our secret notes. She never did. Undoubtedly, she would have needed a magnifying glass to read them. So.
And it is tiny because she includes a photograph of these pieces of chalk with teeny tiny writing on it.
I have never heard that before.
I've never heard of such a thing either.
I didn't know you could pass chalk notes.
And, you know, I don't hesitate to mention it because normally I wouldn't want to give ideas to young school children.
Yes.
But there is no chalk anymore in the classrooms, so they wouldn't be able to use that.
Well, you can't write on your magic markers, you know, your dry erase marker. Excuse me. You don't want to use a magic marker on a whiteboard because it's really hard to get off. But every page, this is... big coffee table book that Marcia's done, and it's beautifully composed. You'll learn something on every page, and so if you have it out for holiday guests, you can just turn the page and, you know, they can be entertained.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed her book, too. In fact, I couldn't wait to turn the next page to see what interesting little tidbit I would learn about the postal system, about letter writing, and a thoroughly entertaining book, as well as visually very pleasing.
Yeah.
And it's been such a great year for books, as you say, Dan, and I always enjoy inviting you to come in so we can talk about these wonderful books at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, you're
in.
Quite welcome.
My guest has been Dan Barnett. He is the columnist who writes the book review for the Chico Enterprise Record. I'd also like to thank my first guest, freelance writer Eric Miller. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.